From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, America, Who Stole the Dream? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Barlett and James Steele talk about their new investigative series, which began yesterday in the Philadelphia Inquirer. They say the rich are getting richer and everyone else is growing poorer, and it's a result of government tax and trade policies. Trade policies which are trading away jobs to other countries, enabling corporations to treat workers as if they were expendable. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's Emmy Awards, and we meet a Pip, Bubba Knight of Gladys Knight and the Pips. Tomorrow, we meet Gladys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. President Clinton today called on Congress to approve $1 billion in funding to fight terrorism and improve airline and airport security. The president is backing a panel's recommendations to place bomb detection devices in airports, bolster FBI anti-terrorism efforts, and conduct immediate background checks of airport workers with access to secure areas. During the Oval Office announcement, the president was asked about the Kurdish factions fighting in northern Iraq.
We're doing everything we can to get out of Iraq American citizens and those who have worked with us. And we have done everything we could to make it clear to the Kurds that we think that there should not be any cavalier killing of civilians and others who are not combatants in this. But we are doing everything that we believe we can do and that we think is appropriate.
The president would not comment on reports that about 200 Iraqis who belong to the U.S.-financed Iraqi National Congress are holed up at a mountain resort, fearful that the United States has abandoned them since Saddam Hussein's forces captured the city of Erbil 8 days ago. According to economists for the country's top corporations, the nation's economy should continue to grow through 1997. They also see an improving trade performance, offsetting slowdowns in business investment and housing construction. In their new forecast, the business economists still insist that economic activity will start to slow later this year and into 1997. They do concede that they have been too pessimistic about how much of a slowdown will occur. In Bosnia, international officials are scrambling to make last-minute preparations for national elections scheduled there this week. With just 5 days before the vote, plans for elections are still incomplete. From Sarajevo, NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
Diplomats based here are in almost unanimous agreement that the timetable for the Bosnia peace process is unrealistically short and pressured by the U.S. election campaign. The Clinton administration has promised American voters that U.S. troops here will finish their mission by the end of the year. But preparations for the Bosnian elections have consequently been rushed. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is supervising and monitoring the elections, has managed to find only 890 observers to watch 4,000 polling stations. Ballot forms have been sent to the wrong places. Voter registration is in disarray. Most seriously, as many as 200,000 Muslims may not be able to vote this Saturday for lack of a safe way to cross Serb-held territory to return to their hometowns. I'm Tom Jelton in Sarajevo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 27.37, trading as light. The Nasdaq Composite Index up 1.47. This is NPR News. The American Medical Association has released a study that concludes excessive television viewing may be hazardous to health, especially the health of children. NPR's Brooke Gradstone reports.
The AMA has reviewed more than 25 years of research on TV viewing and has determined that television can have a serious negative impact on matters ranging from cholesterol levels to homicide rates. And today the doctor's organization has issued a set of guidelines for concerned parents. Among the 13 points offered, turn off the TV during mealtimes and before bedtime. Don't place the TV in the family room. Don't make it a focal point of the house. Know what your child is watching. Don't use television as a babysitter. And what is probably the most radical suggestion, limit television use to 1 or 2 high-quality hours per day. The AMA also suggests that doctors take a child's media history, along with a medical history, when probing for the causes of hyperactive, violent, or aggressive behavior, obesity, or sleep disorders. This is Brooke Gladstone reporting.
Rain-swollen rivers in Virginia have started to recede after driving hundreds of people from their homes and closing roads. The flooding was caused by Hurricane Fran. In the northern mountains of Virginia, the National Guard is using all-terrain vehicles to reach flooded areas where people are without electricity and drinking water. In West Virginia, workers have begun to remove mud at Harpers Ferry National Historical Park. Spokeswoman Marcia Starkey describes the situation.
We are in really surprisingly good shape for the water speed and the depth of the water. We have some mud left in buildings. Of course, we expected that. And we have some broken windows and some broken doorways. But other than that, the buildings seem to, at this point, be intact and in good standing order.
I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The middle class is getting squeezed. My guests, Donald Barlett and James Steele, have spent the past 7 years finding out why. They're Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters at the Philadelphia Inquirer and authors of the 1992 bestseller America, What Went Wrong? Their new series, America, Who Stole the Dream?, began yesterday in the Inquirer. The first two installments are about why the global economy is hurting the middle class and how American tax and trade policies are trading away American jobs, enabling the rich to get richer while everyone else grows poorer. Barlett and Steele say that Washington has opened the doors of America, the world's most lucrative consumer market, to foreign products without adequately safeguarding American jobs. Take the example of Boeing. Last week, Boeing cut a deal with Japan, similar to Boeing's earlier agreement with China, which Barlett and Steele investigated. I'll let James Steele explain.
One of the things that happened with Boeing was that as a condition of selling airplanes in China, Boeing said, and the Chinese government insisted, that some of that production would have to be moved to China. Originally, if I'm not mistaken, the 737 and parts of the 747 were to be made over there. Then those parts were to be shipped back to the U.S. In the minds of probably most Americans, the perception of those offsets was that only planes China was buying, parts of them would be produced over there. But the fact of the matter is, much of the 737 tail sections for Boeing planes around the world are being produced in China. Some of the technology is slowly being transferred to the Chinese as part of that agreement. Boeing insists that they had to do this in order to keep the business, to keep it going. But the fact of the matter is, when you look at Boeing's overall employment in the last few years, it's dropped from roughly 150,000 to somewhere in the vicinity of 100,000, in part because of layoffs in Washington State and other parts of the country where Boeing has facilities, as some of that production is shifted overseas. Boeing's explanation is, we have to do this to keep the business. But the irony of the emphasis on exports and on creating high-tech jobs is those are precisely the kinds of jobs that Washington says we need to create more of. And those are precisely many of the jobs that have been eliminated by those agreements.
Boeing actually may be a precursor of the future in terms of high-tech jobs. There are two areas that really fall into this. One is Boeing, and the other, quite frankly, is computer software, both of which are going overseas in large numbers. And these were as Jim indicated, these were the very high-tech jobs that were supposed to be available to American workers that are, in fact, being shipped abroad.
Now, let me see if I understand the situation with Boeing. Boeing wanted to sell planes to China, and China said, you can only sell us planes if you manufacture some of the parts here and give us jobs.
Correct.
We don't do the same thing, do we?
We don't.
And Boeing certainly didn't say to
you
China,
noticed,
well,
you noticed yeah. that.
Okay. Yes.
That's correct, and that's precisely one of the differences between our policies and other nations' policies. Rightly or wrongly, other governments make some insistence, make some demands on in terms of their trade policies, in terms of their industrial policies. We and the great believers in complete unfettered free trade believe that you shouldn't do any of those things. Well, that's well and good, except most of the world is not playing by those rules. And until we realize most of the world is not playing by those rules, we're going to continue to see that merchandise trade deficit going up. We're going to continue to see manufacturing jobs eliminate. You're going to continue to see the middle class losing ground.
And the other aspect of this is this policy is preached by the people in Washington. We're not talking parties here, because it's both Democrats and Republicans. It makes not one whit of difference. It's both parties and economists, none of whom are affected by these policies. It's the working people out there who pay the price for these policies.
No, jobs are moving abroad not just because of the kind of deals that, say, Boeing cut with China, but also it's just cheaper,
exactly,
isn't it, to move to a third world country, a developing country, and pay people a lot less than you're going to pay them in America.
Sure, and again, it's a policy issue. The U.S. government has said that's fine, go ahead and do that. It has actually encouraged U.S. manufacturers and foreign manufacturers to set up shop in the cheapest labor countries in the world and ship the products in.
Give us an example of an industry that moved from America to a developing country because it was just cheaper to set up shop there.
One of the most dramatic ones, of course, was shoes, beginning in the 1960s, all through the 70s, 80s, still going on. There's still some shoe production left in this country, not much. Apparel is another one. Apparel is just flying out of this country. These jobs are not what you would call high-paying manufacturing jobs, but they're certainly good-paying manufacturing jobs, largely held by women in small towns, medium-sized communities throughout America. When we began looking through Labor Department records showing facilities that were shut down in various towns across America because of foreign trade practices, there's a thing you file on this. It read like a Norman Rockwell portrait of America, just one little town after another, places you'd never heard of, places in Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, virtually all up and down the eastern half of the United States and through much of the Midwest, places where the wages were not high, where living standards were not high, but where communities were really being decimated by this. Those industries in particular have really been hit. And what's interesting about that, these are not high-wage jobs. These are, in many cases, people making $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour, not extraordinarily high income by even median family income standards in this country, which are roughly around $38,000, $39,000 now. But those people can't even compete with Chinese workers who are making shoes or, to some extent, Brazilian workers. One of the most amazing things we came across that just astonished us about the shoe issues. Shoes moved out of this country, went to Brazil basically in the 70s and 80s, particularly women's shoes. Now the Brazilian shoe industry, the Brazilian shoe workers are finding they can't compete. And the reason that they can't compete is because they're making a little over $100 a month. $100 a month, but they can't compete because Chinese workers, well, they're making roughly $50 a month. So the Chinese shoe workers are now displacing the Brazilian shoes in the American market. So even the whole prospect of many developing countries developing and having their place in the sun is being supplanted as the next cheapest country comes online.
Does the U.S. government not have enough leverage in negotiating trade agreements?
Well, the United States has the leverage. It has the world's greatest consumer market, which everybody wants to ship their products into. So they have the leverage, i.e. they could close off that market to a particular country or a particular company that in some way was engaging in unfair trade practices. So they have that leverage. The problem is they're very reluctant to use that leverage for fear of being accused of being a protectionist, for fear of setting back free trade policies around the globe, which the U.S. has been a champion of for half a century now. So they have it. The problem is they're just scared to use it.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Jim Steele and Donald Bartlett, investigative reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer. They have a new series which began this week and continues over the next few days. It's called America, Who Stole the Dream? And it's the follow-up to their series, America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? And America, What Went Wrong? America, What Went Wrong? Was a bestseller for about 8 months after it was published in book form. Now, you make the point in your new series that it's not only individuals who are losing their jobs, small businesses are folding because small businesses can't decide that they're gonna move to another part of the world where it's cheaper.
That's exactly right, and it's one of the things that struck us the most. They don't have the option to move, and they also don't have the lobbying clout in Washington when it comes to securing some assistance from the government on various issues. One of the most moving examples of this that struck us both, and we both did work on this, was the rose industry. You go back in this country 25, 30 years, you buy a bouquet of roses on Mother's Day or Valentine's Day or any other time of the year. Almost all those roses were grown in the United States. Now imported roses dominate that market. And the reason they dominate that market were direct result of government policies, not only lower tariffs, but some assistance to South American rose growers to promote their exports, to encourage the development of some industries down there. This is well and good in terms of foreign aid program and so forth, but the question is, what does it do to a domestic industry down the line? In the beginning, you don't realize it's happening. It's just a simple little thing for a year, two, 3 years. Imports are insignificant. You're not aware of what's happening to the underpinnings of that industry, and that's precisely what happened to the rose industry and many others. And when they sought assistance from things like the U.S. Trade Commission, invariably there would be rulings from those commissions saying, we have studied this, we find that domestic industry is not threatened, and that imports do not present a grave concern, and therefore we will not grant you relief in the form of higher tariffs or quotas and so forth. 10-15 years later, that industry is almost gone. You saw it in shoes, you saw it in microwaves, we saw it in televisions, roses. You see it in a whole range of both small and large industries in some cases, but particularly many small industries.
So on Mother's Day and Valentine's Day, we're getting flooded with roses from South America?
Colombia and Ecuador largely, and to some other places in Central America.
This is a case where the U.S. government actually encouraged the growth of the industry in Colombia and then opened up the U.S. market. And basically drove out American rose growers, drove them out of business. And as Jim indicated, these are small businesses, for the most part, in small towns. They don't pay huge wages, but they, when you take all of these and put them together, they contribute to the stability of a community, to the stability of society. And that's what's being undermined here systematically by Washington. And the other part that Jim mentioned, which is really important, is that the rose growers, when they seek help, they're told in Washington, this isn't a problem, don't worry about it, you're going to be fine. And we saw this over and over and over again in other industries, in which members of Congress, regulatory agencies, presidents would say, this is not a problem, your industry is going to survive nicely. And without exception, they were flat wrong. And Jim touched on shoes. One of the great quotes we have in this series that's coming up, actually, is a quote from Wilbur Mills in 1962 on the trade bill that was enacted that year. And he was getting letters from shoemakers in Arkansas saying, this bill is going to hurt us. And Mills, in only the arrogant way of Washington, says, you don't have to worry. Imports account for a tiny percentage of shoes sold in this country. You will never be hurt by it. Wilbur Mills, like every other member of Congress and every other president since the 60s, has been flat wrong on those subjects. And that's one of the things we try to document throughout the book, are what lawmakers in particular said, what presidents said, and then what happened afterward.
And it's not just manufacturing jobs that are moving. You write about how insurance claims,
right,
processing insurance claims is beginning to move to Ireland.
That's right. There are many white-collar jobs, many clerical jobs, not only Ireland, parts of the Caribbean, any place where they can ship things offshore. It was a very moving series of interviews we had with some women down in New Orleans who worked at a large insurer who'd processed claims for a long time. And what was moving about the interview was how they found out what had happened to them. They were told the office was closing. They were told it didn't have enough work, and so they would have to shift some of the work to other places. And it wasn't until several days later that boxes arrived with labels on them to ship them to a place in Ireland that they realized where their work was going. And that's the way a lot of people are being treated. They're not really being told what's happening. They're not being explained that they're not worthless. It's just the fact that they're working for too much money. In this case, it was roughly around $20,000 or $22,000, $23,000 a year. But in this new global economy, that's too much money for some companies to pay.
If you're just joining us, my guests are James Steele and Donald Bartlett, investigative reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their investigative series, America, What Went Wrong, which was made into a book, was a bestseller. They have a current series running now in the Inquirer called America, Who Stole the Dream? And that will be published in book form in mid-October. Why don't we take a short break and then talk some more? This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Back with Donald Bartlett and James Steele, investigative reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer. They're in the middle of a new series in the Inquirer called America, Who Stole the Dream? And that will be published in book form in mid-October. There's always a politician who will stand up and explain to us that, yes, we're losing jobs abroad, but there are so many new jobs being created in America that we're actually in fine shape. You find a fallacy in that argument as well.
Yes. The problem is the jobs being created are really at the bottom end. And there are jobs that just don't pay very much money. A lot of them also are part-time jobs. They're not full-time jobs. A lot of them don't have benefits. They do not equate at all with the jobs being eliminated. In most cases, all of these jobs that Jim has talked about and I mentioned earlier, they had health care, they had pensions, guaranteed pensions. These are basically all gone now, and people are paying their own health care, or at least a good portion of it, and they're really contributing to their own pension plan, which may or may not pay them a pension when they retire.
The bottom line on all these things, you'll hear people argue about what kinds of jobs are being created, what do they do? But when you look at the overall statistics about what's happening in this country for a long time, this is the bottom line. And one of the things we looked at, which was a number that just astonished us, we looked at the earnings of all blue and white collar workers outside of government, and everybody who's in private industry, you know, shipping clerks to nurses, truck drivers, musicians, not managers, not general managers, but just basically everybody who does the work, 73 million people. Well, basically, their average annual salary in 1995 was $20,559. That was down $3,500 from their earnings in 1975, if you adjust that group for inflation. So they've lost that much during that period of time, 20 years. And that's what you see being replicated in group after group among broad parts of the middle class.
There's in the talk about these new jobs and who's being hurt in the middle class, later in the week we're going to focus in particular on women who are really bearing the brunt of this. A lot of doors opened from women in the late 70s and the 80s. Those doors are slamming shut. For professional women, it's fine. But for working women, the options out there are becoming slimmer, and the pay options in particular are not good at all. And we're almost in a way creating a kind of an electronic plantation economy for women out there.
What do you mean by that? And why are women being more hard hit by
the
loss of jobs?
Well, it's like you mentioned the claims processors moving the work to Ireland. These are jobs which were basically filled by women, sometimes a lot of cases, single mothers. It was the sole source of income. In other cases, it was a wife working to help support a family. Those jobs are being eliminated. They were full-time, full benefits, and the replacement jobs are not. And so women in particular, from that standpoint, are being really hard hit.
Oh, why do you make the analogy to electronic plantations?
Well, because like the paper processing, almost any act you do today that involves paper can be done anywhere in the world. At the press of a keystroke, that work can be transmitted to India, it can be sent to Ireland, it can be sent to Barbados, it can be sent anywhere in the world to be done. And at the touch of a keystroke, the finished product can be sent back. It doesn't have to be done in an office in a small town in America or in a big city in this country anymore. It can be shipped anywhere.
Well, we've discussed the loss of jobs that has resulted from global trade policies. We hear a lot about retraining. You know, people are being retrained. They'll find new jobs, and you're very pessimistic about that.
Wow. I don't know where we begin with that one. We're going to deal a whole part in a series. We'll deal with that actually be next week. But if you look at what people are being retrained for, they are systematically, as a result of government policies, being retrained for jobs that will pay less than they earned in their last jobs. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves as a society is, why do you spend money to educate someone to make less money? And that is the official policy of both the Democrats and the Republicans. People are being retrained so they can make less money and have fewer benefits and move down the scale. We looked at one small one company in particular, and the number of workers undergoing retraining for, quote, building maintenance, unquote, was staggering. There were dozens of them. there isn't a need for dozens of janitors in a small town in western Pennsylvania. But yet the government has encouraged this.
And
the education bureaucracy loves it. It's billions of dollars flowing into them. You're talking serious money here. If you look at all training, retraining programs for the 90s so far, you're looking at $100 billion. There is a huge vested special interest here, and that special interest is not the people being retrained. They have no say in what's going to happen to them. They have little choice, and their options are very narrow.
It's also become a way for government, in a way, to take the sting out of people losing their jobs a little bit. In other words, it gives them more unemployment than they ordinarily would get if they enroll in one of these retraining programs. So even if they don't get a job or they get a job that pays less, they've received unemployment for a longer period. So it becomes a way to cushion that immediate blow. But in terms of actually providing jobs, which is what all the speeches are about, and retraining people for the future, this program is failing miserably.
Don, who are the special interests that you're referring to that you think are actually benefiting by the retraining?
Well, the educational bureaucracy benefits hugely from it because that's where the money goes. And that varies from privately owned technical schools all the way up to universities who collect the money for people attending these classes. There are so many fascinating aspects to this. And one we learned was that there's been no systematic study of everybody who's undergoing retraining. And as one person involved in that in the state told us, who's been active in retraining for 20 years, he said the reason is everybody knows the answer and nobody wants it in print out there. He said basically 95% of the people who are retrained are working for much less money than they made in their old jobs. And you have maybe 5% who are making money. And most of the people do not even get jobs in the fields for which they were retrained. And in the few limited surveys that have been conducted, a school will say, well, we placed 30% of our workers. Well, the worker was retrained as an electrician and ultimately had to accept a job at McDonald's. That's counted as a placement. It is a very, very dishonest system for working Americans.
Donald Barlett and James Steele are investigative reporters at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their new series, America, Who Stole the Dream, concludes September 22nd. Barlett and Steele will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more reasons why the middle class is losing out in the global economy. We continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Barlett and James Steele. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's Emmy Awards, and we meet a Pip, Bubba Knight of Gladys Knight and the Pips. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Barlett and James Steele. They've written a new series called America, Who Stole the Dream?, investigating how American tax and trade policies are hurting the middle class. The series began yesterday in the Philadelphia Inquirer. We've been talking largely about global trade policies and how a lot of American businesses are moving to developing countries where labor is cheap. The losers are American workers. Who are the winners?
Well, certainly many of the multinational corporations, which have now shifted so much of their operations abroad to import back into this country or to supply markets abroad, they have been winners. Their stockholders have been winners, which were obviously some of us, as some Americans, but they have been winners. But what is amazing to us is how dramatically and how quickly this has changed. I mean, one of the companies that we look at is Colgate-Palmolive, one of the oldest corporations in America, dates back to 1806 when they began selling candles on Wall Street, of all places. You go back to 1980, Colgate had more than 20,000 employees domestically in the U.S., 20-some thousand foreign employees scattered around the globe. Colgate has cut more than 15,000 people from its workforce. It's now down to almost 6,000 people in domestic employment. At the same time, its foreign workforce has gone up over 33,000. Colgate, yes, it's headquartered here. Colgate, you think of as an American company, but it's not really a U.S. corporation in the way it was as recently as the 1970s. They're a winner in this thing, and there's a whole series of companies like that. They're in that same position. Many people who have also benefited very heavily from this are a very tiny number of certainly folks at the very top. Folks who own part of this, folks who invest in this. But the losers are the vast bulk of Americans.
What about lobbyists? You list lobbyists as among the group of winners. How are they winning?
They win by generating perpetual business for themselves and guaranteeing that all of these things that have taken place that are eliminating jobs continue. There's such a movement of lobbyists between government. They go into government and at the taxpayer expense basically get an education, for example, in trade policy. Then they come out of government and set up either their own lobbying firm or join a law firm that specializes in lobbying. And these are people that certainly we talk about the top one percenters, that group at the top of the income class in this country. These are people who fall into that group.
What are they lobbying for that relates to this? Who do they represent?
They represent everybody from the large multinationals who want to make sure that there's no restrictions on imports from China. They represent foreign governments, foreign trade associations, everything from the Korea Semiconductors Association to Taiwanese steel producers to they're on down the line. It's a fascinating office in Washington that chronicles all of these filings that come in. And one of the most interesting things to us is that the increase in the representatives from those specific countries that export to us, the number of their agents that now operate in Washington versus, let's say, 25 or 30 years ago, a substantial increase in the number who now represent those various commercial interests from abroad. And what's interesting to us, which we came across, were any number of examples about where those foreign governments or associations will advocate free trade policies for the United States. At the same time, their own governments, of course, have restricted policies where they don't believe in that. But they know by talking about free trade and global trade and the wonders of it, that will have a certain resonance with everything from editorial writers to newspaper reporters to commentators in this country, but they don't practice that even at home. So they've been very successful in getting their point of view across. At the same time, the average American doesn't have any representation before those bodies.
You know, can't we argue that these trade policies, which are allowing American corporations to farm out work to developing countries where labor is cheap, that those policies are actually benefiting all of us as consumers because we can buy things that are less expensive than they would be if they were made in America?
I think, you know, that's the argument you hear over and over, and it's an appealing argument. There's no doubt about it. And I think we pose the question this way, and it's this, that if you have a society that's built on the economic principle, that all that matters is the lowest price, that society is going to differ substantially from one that says everyone who wants to work should have a living wage. And that principle really gets to the heart of what kind of society we're going to ultimately have in this country, because right now the lowest possible price policy is the one that's in effect, and it doesn't seem to be any movement to change it. And as a result, we're going to have a very different kind of society in this country, and it may not be a very nice one.
It also gets back to a point you made at the beginning of the program, which is a very good one, which is what we're trying to emphasize in this series, and it's a matter of balance. It's not a matter of shutting off everything that's coming in from abroad. It's a matter of trying to maintain some kind of a balance between your export and import ledger, which we've not been able to do in recent years, and that's what's led to this erosion. It also gets down to the fact that if some country is exporting to us and we're receiving those imports, there should be some reciprocity. They should buy our products or at least not block our products. When the Clinton administration came to Washington in 1993, one of the things they singled out that said just had to be changed, and that was the skyrocketing trade deficit with China. And at the time, it was running at roughly $18 billion a year. Well, since they've come in, the trade deficit with China has gone up 85%. So they've had absolutely no success in lowering that deficit at all. And the reason for that is the Chinese are refusing to buy certain things, just as the Japanese before them refused to buy certain things, because they know when push comes to shove, we will complain about it, but essentially do nothing about it.
My guests are James Steele and Donald Barlett, investigative journalists at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalists Donald Barlett and James Steele, the Philadelphia Inquirer is now publishing their new series, America, Who Stole the Dream? Your series in the Philadelphia Inquirer is running right at the height of election campaign season. Is this an aggravating time of year for you as you listen to politicians take important issues and put their own spin on it?
You know, this is a really critical question, and I'll answer this by talking not about what we think, but what about the people we interviewed thought. And the difference between those interviews conducted in the last 2 years and from America, What Went Wrong, which started in, 90 and 91, and the bulk of the interviews were conducted. Back at that time, when you interviewed people across the country, the questions were more of what can we do to fix this, you know, what can be done, this is a serious problem, we've got to do something. And in that sense, What Went Wrong was the what, and the current series and the current book is the why. And the interviews this time were starkly different. I don't recall any stridency in any interview I had in America, What Went Wrong. That's gone. And there are three quotes that just jumped out, and these were just ordinary working people, and they come from all walks of life. It's just not blue collar, it's professional white collar. And one was a factory worker in Kansas who said, "Are we just going to keep lowering our standard of living? When that happens, nobody's going to have money to put food on the table. Then you are going to see a revolution because people are not going to be able to feed their families." And a factory worker in Pennsylvania, put it more bluntly, said, "There's going to be bloodshed before we get out of this. There is a deep, seething anger out there that is being misread, and it's not being observed. And this is a huge, huge difference from just 5 years ago. And it comes back to that question of what kind of a society does this country want? What kind of a society is it going to have? Because what these people are seeing is not pretty." And to get to the political aspect of it, over and over and over again, these people are turning out both parties and indicating that it doesn't matter which party you vote for, neither one is fixing what's broken, so it doesn't matter if you vote or not.
Do you think that some politicians are consciously trying to manipulate that anger, to play into that anger.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. You mean in terms of some of the social issues, yeah, and the welfare, yeah. Certainly a lot of the debate on welfare probably would go to the heart of that, because a lot of the people who are working and are paying some taxes are probably very angry that they're paying any taxes when they're not making much money. So a lot of that anger then gets turned to those below them, and it's a very common kind of thing. It's also fueled by the fact that much of the tax burden on those people has increased substantially in recent years, not just at so much at the federal level through Social Security and Medicare, but through state and local tax burden as well.
You're absolutely right about that, because what's happening is these policies and some politicians are just pitting one group against another, one social group against another, blacks against whites, Hispanics and Asians against blacks, people who have health care against people without health care, people who have pensions against people without pensions, people who have lost their jobs and forced into lower-paying jobs against people who have not lost their jobs. It is pitting one group against another, and that also is contributing to this kind of very slow unraveling of the fabric of society out there. And this was driven home to us in an interview with one worker in a small town where a factory closes down, everybody loses their jobs, everybody's scrambling to find another job. And the worker said, in years gone by, if someone had lost their job, that person would have been told by someone at their church, by a friend, by a neighbor, hey, there's a job opening down the street. He said, now it is every person from themselves, and no one will help another person. And what is disappearing is that, community spirit that's so important for a healthy society.
And the fact is, I think they feel, too, they've been misled by them in a whole series of ways, if not in some cases almost lied to. And they know that, and they repeat these things back to us. I mean, one of the most dramatic examples of this on simply a trade issue is NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. That was sold largely on the basis that we would sell so many goods to Mexico. They'll lower our tariffs so we can sell to them. Our tariffs are already low. And everybody pointed to the fact that we had a trade surplus with Mexico, one of the few sizable countries, in fact, that we did have a trade surplus with. The minute NAFTA was approved, the trade surplus vanished. And in fact, last year, we had a huge trade deficit with Mexico, $16 billion, wiping out all surpluses, and then some for many years prior to that. But yet people think back to the time they were told by Washington, vote for this so we can sell more to Mexico and create more jobs at home. They were told that by the politicians, they were told that by the media, and they were told that by the academia. So they feel disenfranchised by that because it hasn't worked out that way, and they know it because many of them have lost their jobs.
What makes that so striking with NAFTA is the fact that the results are evident so quickly after the statements were made. When you're looking at these industries over a period of 2 decades, for the most part, nobody remembers what Wilbur Mills said in 1962 about shoe workers until, his words are long forgotten. And that's what's so striking about NAFTA. It's one of the few instant
turnarounds in effect.
Yeah.
If your research shows in such a clear-cut way how certain government trade policies are actually hurting American workers, why do you think the government keeps continuing in that same direction?
Well, that goes to the heart of the lobbying issue. The lobbyists for that particular point of view really control Washington. And there's also both parties have a very hardcore of people who sincerely believe in what they're doing. And later on in this series, we make this point that there have been these people in government forever and in the business world forever who sincerely believe in what they are doing, but what they are doing turns out to be terrible in the end. And you go back and you read Robert McNamara's quotes in 1966, and then you read them in 1995, and they're a little bit different. You see the same thing in economic policies today in Washington. People sincerely believe that what they are doing is right, when if you step back and look at what the comments that their predecessors made 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years ago, who also thought they were doing the right things, every one of them has been wrong.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Oh, our pleasure.
Thank you, Terry.
Donald Barlett and James Steele have written a new investigative series for the Philadelphia Inquirer called America, Who Stole the Dream? The 10-part series continues through Sunday, September 22nd, and will then be published in book form. For last night's Emmy Award show, only members of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences got to vote. Today, though, our TV critic David Bianculli gets to vote on what he thought about ABC's entire telecast.
It used to be you could count on the Emmys for one obscure or laughable winner every year. I still remember the time Lindsay Wagner won Best Dramatic Actress for The Bionic Woman. This year, that kind of surprise win seemed to be the rule, not the exception. And the surprises continued to the very end when NBC's ER was voted Outstanding Drama Series. Now, I realize ER is the most popular drama on TV. I also realize the two of last year's best drama series, Due South and Homicide: Life on the Street, weren't even nominated, making it easier for ER to claim the crown. But what I don't understand is that ER hadn't won a single award all night. So here's my question of the day. How does a show get nominated, like ER was, for Best Actor, Actress, Supporting Actor, Supporting Actress, Writing, and Direction? How does a show get nominated for all that and lose in every single category and still walk away with top honors? Don't ask me. Ask the Academy. And while you're asking, ask about some of those earlier winners, too. In the non-craft categories, no single show won more than two Emmy Awards last night. Emmys were handed out to such actors as Tyne Daly for a guest appearance on the CBS drama series Christie, to Tom Hulce for a supporting role in an adaptation of The Heidi Chronicles on TNT, to Amanda Plummer for an episode of The Outer Limits on Showtime, and to Tony Bennett for a Valentine's Day music special that ran only on the A&E cable network. Never before in the history of television have so many Emmys been given out to so many performers whose work was seen by so few. Viewers could be forgiven for being a little ignorant about some of the nominees and winners, and apathetic about the results. But for the presenters, who got their lists of nominees in time to check and rehearse pronunciations, ignorance was no excuse. For example, the way Christine Lottie of Chicago Hope butchered the name of Greta Saatchi was unforgivable, especially since Christine Lottie acted like neither the actress nor the category was of any interest to her whatsoever. At least when host Paul Reiser botched the name of actress Alfre Woodard, he came back and apologized.
That's right. There is no D at the name of Alfre Woodard. It's Alfre, not Alfred. That's a whole other name. I'm wrong. Just checked with our statisticians. To compensate, if Hitchcock comes out, I'm calling him Alfre.
But the on-air mistakes that bothered me most weren't the mispronunciations or even the dumb votes. The mistakes that really got me were the superimposed misspellings, the ones that popped up almost every time ABC showed one of its history of TV montages. The Academy was supposed to be celebrating its 50th anniversary and showing those clips to honor TV's very best shows and performers. But when it showed Hill Street Blues, its on-air label spelled Hill Street as one word. Later on, Liza Minnelli was given only one N, a mistake that once irritated her so much she sang a whole song about it. And worst of all, one of the medium's true giants, talk show host Jack Parr, had his last name spelled not P-A-A-R, but P-A-R-R. When the presenters and producers of the Emmys don't know or care enough about TV, why should viewers? Next year, the Academy should come prepared with the right attitude, and with Rosie O'Donnell as host.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, Bubba Knight, a founding Pip, as in Gladys Knight and the Pips. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll hear from the great soul singer Gladys Knight. For most of her career, her singing was set off by the background vocals and dance steps of the Pips. And everyone wants to know how the Pips worked out those dance steps and vocals. So we got in touch with Gladys's brother, Bubba Knight, one of the founding Pips. And he told me about their record, Midnight Train to Georgia.
Midnight Train to Georgia was such a great song. We wanted to color that song with train sounds, like whoop-whoo, all of that kind of thing. We wanted to make that combination, and that's how we came up with it. We just focused on making it a home song, first of all, being Midnight Train to Georgia. And that's the way we did it, and it was it just came kind of naturally.
And what were the hand gestures that went along with it?
Basically, we did a like pulling the cord on a train whistle. We would jerk down on the cord, and that's how the choreography formed. Where it would look like we were riding a train. I don't know, we were just being creative. And it worked.
Well, let's hear Midnight Train to Georgia, Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Too much for the man.
He couldn't make it.
So he's leaving the life. He's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going back
to find.
Going back to find.
Ooh, 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 what's left of his world? The world he left behind. Not so long ago. He's leaving.
Leaving.
On that midnight train. Georgia. Yeah. Said he's going back.
Going back
to a simpler place and time. Oh, yes, he is. Now be with him.
I know you will.
On that midnight train, Georgia.
Leaving on that midnight train.
I'd rather live in his world.
How did you come up with what syllables to sing? Like when it should be an ooh and when it should be an ah, or when you should be singing on a word?
It was basically created around what feeling Gladys had at that particular moment. If she had a soft or an easy kind of a sound, we didn't want to distract from that by being ah or being yeah, or saying words like that would distract from that moment or that space that she was in right there. So we would do oohs and soften it up to go with what she was doing so that we would flow together. And then when she would get excited or be more vocal, we would then support that with yes and ahs and, you know, more of a strong sound. That's how we tried to create it.
Now, tell me about your dance moves. I know even before you joined Motown, you were working with a choreographer. In fact, you worked with Charlie Atkins, who later became one of Motown's choreographers.
Exactly.
So how would you work with him to figure out the dance moves?
Well, Charlie Atkins was not only a dance teacher, he was also our mentor. He had a way of teaching us choreography that it was in stages. It was like A, B, C, D, E, and F. And he taught the section A so well. He drilled it in us so well that when we got ready to put B to A, it was natural. And we never forgot A because of the way that Charlie Atkins taught us. He taught us the ABCD way because He always told us if he wasn't around and we ran into problems in memorizing some of the steps, or we got to a point where as it didn't flow smoothly, we could go back in and pick out whichever section, A, B, C, D, or E, and just work on that section.
What were some of the typical steps and hand movements that you worked out?
Pop was never typical. His most simple steps became some of the most difficult. And he'll tell you that today. He said, I will teach you a difficult step and you guys will pick it up right away and I'll give you something simple and you struggle with it. I don't know. I don't understand that.
Well, what's the difference between a simple step and a difficult step? Well, could you describe them?
Well, it's a little difficult to describe. Now, a simple step would be for us, say, for instance, to take our left foot and plant it to our left and drag the right foot while at the same time taking your hand and making it curl and pulling it back with your right foot as it's sliding. This is a simple step. But to make it in sync, where the three of us would look identical in doing this, sometimes became difficult because one would have their hand too low, one would have their hand too high, or, you know, that type of thing, or we would curl our hands at the wrong time or something like that, which was very, you know, it's simple, but it became difficult at times. And now he would teach us, say, a soft shoe step, and we would pick it up right away.
So it must have been really hard to stay in sync, but that was really important to do.
Very important. He would dwell on the fact that we must look like one when we perform our choreography. And that was one of his most adamant kind of concerns for us. He wanted us to be as one. And that's how we rehearsed to be as one, and we would stand in front of that mirror hours at a time trying to look like each other.
Bubba Knight was a founding member of the Pips and is now Gladys Knight's road manager. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Gladys Knight. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shirock. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the great soul singer Gladys Knight. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.